I also think it's important to just like have a culture of talking about biases and like what we should correct for and what we shouldn't.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, I'm joined by Christine Spang. Christine is the co-founder and CTO of Nihilus. Nihilus's API powers communications in software applications. They take data from 4.5 billion inboxes worldwide, and they connect it directly to productivity, sales, and marketing apps. You probably use Nihilus and some of the apps you use every day. Nihilus has raised $30 million in funding, and they have 20 engineers across 4 teams. In this episode, we talk about Christine's entrepreneurial journey. We also talk about building a support network as a founder and about building a diverse team with less bias. In this conversation, we touch on two topics that are essential to professional success: getting enough sleep and using rubrics to hire more effectively. These two things have transformed my life and my business, and I think we can all learn from Christine's perspective. And now, here's my conversation with Christine Spang. Christine, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes. It's really great to be on board and be having this conversation today.
So what got you into building software?
I really got into building software actually when I was in high school. I was kind of like on an emotional level. I was like trying to find activities that kind of let me escape a bit. And one thing that I found that was really interesting in that vein was, first it was books, and then later I got into computer games, and especially like role-playing and strategy games, starting with kind of graphical things like Age of Empires and StarCraft, but kind of over time, like branching more and more into like games that just involve like creating a character and like exploring a world. So eventually that led me to this class of games called MUDs, which were these like text-based games that you play online. And I got really into this Lord of the Rings themed MUD called Shadows of Isildur. And after playing the game for, I don't know, probably less than a year, I got so into it that the people that were running it asked me to help them run it. So I started being a role play administrator on that game, kind of like making up storylines and plots and making things happen in the world, which made things really interesting for all the players. And from that, I got to a point where they had like these in-game tools that you could use to like build new rooms and kind of different areas and objects and things like that. But if you wanted to be able to kind of alter that very like fabric of the world and add new capabilities, you had to know how to code. And the game engine was written in C based on this really old MUD code base called Deku MUD. And I basically like started teaching myself C in high school because I really wanted to like work on this game. And that never really happened, but through a series of jumps of working on teaching myself C, and then also the game only ran on Linux, so I had to install Linux and figure that out. Eventually, like through a series of hops of curiosity, I would say, I went from like installing Linux to curious about like how does like this operating system come to be. I read different things about like the operating system that I installed was this flavor of Linux called Debian. And one of the interesting things about Debian is that it's completely volunteer run. So there's like 1,000 developers all around the world who, you know, work completely asynchronously and collaborate through mailing lists. And somehow every 2 years release a fully functional operating system. And that kind of blew my mind. So I like started following like the blog aggregator for all the developers. And one day there was a developer who made a post about this group called Debian Women that was, you know, it was like an affinity group for encouraging women to like get involved in working on Debian. And that really spoke to me because I felt like I was the target audience. So I like joined their IRC channel and like eventually like started teaching myself Python so I could help work on some like Debian related stuff. So it was this like kind of very curiosity-driven path throughout high school, like in my free time, that led me to actually like building things. And I always knew that I wanted to be an engineer because, I don't know, I was like really into science and math in school. And I have a fair number of family members who are in some flavor of engineering. Like my dad was an electrical engineer. My grandpa was a chemical engineer who actually eventually got into computers because he thought they were more interesting than chemical engineering. And that was like way in the early days in like, you know, the 70s or 60s or whatever. And computers were huge then. So I had this idea since forever that I wanted to be an engineer, but that's such a broad category. And through this path that I took in high school, I came out of that being like, I want to be a software engineer.
So a story I tell about myself is I played MMOs and some MUDs early on. And a story I tell about myself is that doing that, like leading voluntary groups where you have to kind of motivate people and everyone can leave whenever they want, has made me a better leader. Do you ever think that your MUD days, you know, being a role play administrator helped you at your job now?
I don't know. I think there's like some crossovers, and then there's also just like some things about like being in a group of humans that is largely in person, but also like in kind of a commercial setting is also different in a number of ways. I don't know. Learning stuff about how people interact is like always helpful to you in a professional setting as your career grows. So it's like a little hard for me to separate that from like all of the lessons of just like living.
And so you got into Debian, to the women's affinity group. You knew you want to be an engineer. When in your career, when did you transition from building software to leading teams that build software?
Yeah. So basically, the path was, you know, decided in high school I wanted to be a software engineer. That led me to apply to a number of different schools that were really good for CS. And my top choice was to go to MIT. And I completely didn't think I would ever get in. It was like kind of my secret application that I like made but never told anyone. And then when I got in, I was just like, oh, cool. So I ended up going to MIT, and then through that got into startups in this kind of like weird tangential way, in that really the defining or like the pivotal moment in that set off this like chain of events in my career was not anything that happened like after my career had started. It was literally like getting into open source software in high school, because I can trace like a direct path from that to where I am today. So being involved in Debian basically got me my first couple jobs. So like my freshman year, actually before I went to MIT, I like ended up working in the MIT Media Lab at this lab group, because when I was visiting MIT as a pre-freshman at the kind of preview weekend, I hung out with some Debian people and they toured the lab where they worked, and like some guy there was like, oh, someone who knows how to code who's coming to MIT. I need like more minions in my lab. So I ended up working there. So that was pretty cool, because like I literally like graduated from high school on like a Saturday, and then on Monday I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts and started working in this lab. And that continued in that I met a bunch of folks through this organization at MIT called the Student Information Processing Board, or SIPB, which is basically the MIT Computer Club. And that is what led me to my first job after college, which was at this tiny startup called Caseplace, which was building this like rootless kernel technology for Linux. And I got that job because I knew the folks who started it through SIPI, and I was actually sponsoring Debian package uploads for one of the founders who was working on this math software called Sage. And I had at that point become like an official Debian developer contributor, and was able to like make new uploads of different software to the archive, and was doing that for Tim Abbott, who's one of the founders of Caseplace. So that's how I ended up working at Caseplace. Yeah, so it was like literally all through like free and open source software, and then ended up at this tiny bootstrap startup. And that was definitely my first like real work experience. And also I had never really like thought that much about like startups as a concept before that. I know that there's like a group of people that like gets into entrepreneurship as a concept and decides that they want to be an entrepreneur, but that's not really the path that led me to startups. It was always this like technical open source software path. And so eventually after K-Splice, I started my own company called Nihlus. And we are basically building a platform that makes it much easier for developers to integrate with unstructured data like email, contacts, and calendar. And basically, I transitioned to leadership as a part of like the complete fire hose of starting this company. So like the first year after starting it was really focused on building. You know, we were like less than six people the whole time. I started out by building a lot of our original backend infrastructure, our like IMAP sync engine for connecting to IMAP. I figured out how to get our stuff running on AWS and stuff like that. And I was really just kind of like a mid-level engineer when I started the company. You know, I had 3 years of experience at a previous company and was definitely like flying by the seat of my pants in that we were like trying to build the product. And then like we hired a few people. The first people we hired were like acquaintances from college. And then it kind of branched out into like this one guy that we met in a cafe. Who just happened to be like a completely badass front-end engineer, but it was a very like spontaneous way that we met each other because we were like working in cafes at the time. We didn't have an office.
So that's a recruiting strategy. Just have everyone work in cafes and serendipity will hit. You find badass front-end engineers.
Yeah, I don't recommend that as like a way to bootstrap your company, but sometimes random stuff happens and that's just the way it works. So basically as the company grew over time, I don't know, like as a founder, you kind of just have to like do whatever needs to be done to like keep the company going. And at some point, like the thing that needed to be done was like someone needed to manage the other engineers. And so I basically like went out and talked to all the people I knew that had like management and leadership experience and was like, help, what do I do? How do I do this? And like they gave me some book recommendations. I've always been a really big reader, so reading books helps me.
What were some of the books that you got the most value out of during that transition?
I think the first book that a friend recommended to me actually was this book by this guy named Jerry Weinberg called Becoming a Technical Leader. And the things that it focuses on is really this like transition from being primarily hands-on and building things to moving into like leadership skills and how to like lead and organize a team, and also just talking about how important people skills are in the craft of building software. So I don't remember specific lessons that I took away from it, but it made a big impression on me in terms of like really solidly outlining why leadership is important and why you should spend a lot of time working on it, because it's so much easier to focus on technical skills, but that's probably not what's holding you back.
It was Becoming a Technical Leader is the title of that book?
Yep.
I will link to that in the show notes. Do you, so thinking about that transition and thinking where you are now and what you've learned, what are some things that younger Christine maybe missed? If you could give your past self advice, I think the fact that you went out and asked and realized how important the people side were, like that's like step zero for success, but it's still pretty hard.
I think one lesson that I would have liked to have internalized earlier is that it's really important to have friends and mentors that you can be really open with about like your feelings and that are really supportive. I think it's really common, especially as a founder, to like hold things in and try to be really stoic, but you know, vulnerability is a huge part of connection, and you're going to feel way better about everything you're going through if like you find the right folks to be really open with and share your struggles, because even if those people don't have solutions, like they may have gone through similar things, and just like having this connection and support from other people makes things infinitely easier to handle.
And how did you find those folks? Did you go to meetups or are they folks from school?
Yeah, it was kind of organically over time. Some of them were through meetups. One person I really lean on a lot is a friend, Charity Majors, who actually has another company.
Yeah, Honeycomb.
Yeah, yeah, they're great. We use their product. It's wonderful. And I don't know, we like kind of met each other at this ops meetup. And just like in a time of crisis for me, she was the person who was there. And like, I will never forget that.
I've heard that emotion described as like a pipe. So if you don't let some of it out, it forces itself out sometimes in surprising ways, and like trying to not share things results in just squirting out in the wrong place. And like, that's been true in my life. So I love that analogy though.
I think it's also just really bad for you physically. Like you can get all sorts of, you can get sick from holding things in, like physically.
I've heard you, you've talked about how sleep is really important to you now. Speaking of other things that might be bad for you physically, how do you incorporate getting enough sleep into making yourself effective at your job?
Yeah, this is something that's really evolved for me over time. I don't know, when I was at MIT, I learned a lot of really important life lessons. And the thing I learned in my freshman year was that if I did not get enough sleep, I was literally going to fail out of college. There's this tradition at MIT of students basically staying up late into the night and like going exploring around campus and climbing on top of buildings and stuff like that and playing pranks. And it's a really cool and interesting tradition. And I found that if I stayed up too late and I didn't get enough sleep, I just like was not doing well as a student. Luckily, when you're a freshman at MIT, there's this thing called pass no record, which essentially means that if you fail any classes your freshman year, they don't go on your transcript, which is a very great feature because MIT is a really intense place. And like that intensity combined with, you know, it being a typical college experience where all of these young folks are on their own and independent for the first time, they don't have parents who can tell them what to do, like being right there. And you know, you want to break all the rules for a while. It's like, well, maybe I can stay up late and eat ice cream for dinner or whatever. But I think that I maybe learned the lesson faster than most people because I've learned over time that I'm a really sensitive person, and my feedback mechanisms from my body are just like very powerful. So I literally just can't take not taking care of myself for long periods of time. So with this like rapid feedback loop of just like, I completely fall apart if I'm not taking good care of myself. I learned that I can't let that suffer. So I managed to graduate from MIT largely with the help of stopping staying up all night. And that really led me to have this like very internalized sense of like the line at which I will not let my self-care suffer. So I remember coming out of MIT, starting my first job at Caseplace, when chatting with the founders about taking the job, I asked them, I was like, am I going to have to work more than 40 hours a week for this job? Because honestly, it takes a while to recover from MIT. And I felt like I needed time to recover and that I was like figuring stuff out for myself. And I was worried about overloading myself and wanted to make sure that we were on the same page from the very beginning about what my commitment level was. And it was a great job and I was really into it. And when Jeff told me yes on that first day, I was like, okay, I feel good about this.
That you would have to work more than 40 hours a week.
Sorry, he said no. I got that flipped in my head.
You had a firm commitment for how much you would work and you felt you were going to need to work and you felt good about that.
Yeah, so I don't know, that was an experience of like laying out boundaries for myself and it was a good experience. And I've just taken away from that this like very strong internalized sense of like what is worth it and what's not worth it. And even when starting this company, I just decided from the get-go that I wasn't going to sacrifice my physical or emotional well-being in order to like get the company off the ground because it wasn't worth it to me. So with starting the company, I think it was really interesting because I was kind of worried about like the workload and maybe stress level. But I think that there's this interesting interplay where if you find the right thing and you're really excited about it, you actually can work more. And I didn't go into the company being like, I'm going to like work my ass off. But there were times, and there have been times, and there are times at this company where I do work a lot. But I feel like because I came into it with this like internalized sense of what is okay, what's not okay, what can I do, what not can I not do, I still prioritize self-care in a way that is maybe abnormal or unusual or an outlier. But I can do that while also like putting a lot of energy into things that I'm excited about. So I guess kind of tactically, like things I do today is I've discovered over the past 5 years that I'm definitely a morning person, and I allow myself to just like not stay up late like most of the time. So if I'm like at like a work-related dinner, I allow myself to like leave by, you know, 9:30. And sometimes it's still hard to like leave an event before it's done, but I just like think about the next day and like what I would sacrifice from like losing sleep. And I'm like, well, this is gonna make me less productive tomorrow. So it's a motivator to like go home and go to bed. And I don't know, I've developed a bunch of like rituals for kind of winding down, because, you know, sometimes being a startup is really stressful, and you have to be able to like disconnect and transition into like a state of relaxation in order to actually sleep. So, like, for example, one thing that I do is I really like taking like hot baths before bed. So I'll do that like once or maybe twice a week sometimes. And I find that helps me sleep. And recently, in the last couple months, I've actually started using this sleep tracking device called the Oura Ring, which is kind of like a Fitbit, but it's actually a ring. And the reason I got it was like the internet said that its sleep tracking features were like more accurate than the Fitbit. And having that feedback loop of like telling me how well I slept immediately afterwards also helps motivate me to like do the right things to get good sleep.
Yeah, I think tightening anything we can do to tighten feedback loops. Sounds like your body has some pretty tight feedback loops already, but I'm wearing my Fitbit and my Oura Ring right now.
Yeah, but I've always been into kind of these like quantified self type things. I just like love having the data. It's really fun.
Do you use the HRV readiness information at all?
I do, actually, because...
Do you want to quickly explain what HRV is?
Yeah, so HRV stands for heart rate variability. And I guess there's a couple features on the Oura that are kind of related. There's heart rate variability, and then it also measures your heart rate while you're sleeping. So it can determine your resting heart rate really accurately. And I can also like give you a graph of your resting heart rate and HRV over the night while you're sleeping. So those two things together, there's like a little bit of mixed science behind this, but they can help you determine basically your recovery state. So I'm really excited and really into these kinds of things because I'm also really into rock climbing, and I actually train to like perform better at rock climbing. And I have been pleasantly surprised at how useful it is for like determining which days in which I should train hard and which I should back off. So there's this like interplay between like the data and like how you feel. And I find it helps paint a more accurate picture of like how to alter like what I'm doing and like when I should like prioritize like going to bed, or like when I should like skip doing something hard because my body is just like not gonna be able to handle it well.
When you see your readiness level as lower, you're gonna skip that hard workout and go to bed earlier. And if it's higher, maybe you push through. Is that kind of the heuristic you're using?
Yeah, definitely. Like yesterday, for example, my quote unquote readiness score was a little bit lower, and so I made sure that when I got home, I decided to like take a bath before bed because I know it helps me sleep better. And then I also, funny story, before this podcast, I had originally set my alarm clock this morning to get up a little bit earlier because I'm trying to readjust after daylight savings time because it's really annoying.
Daylight savings time.
I hate it so much. But I've been trying to get back on my like normal early schedule because like the clocks went forward and I'm like, I don't like being in a rush in the morning. And so I had set my alarm clock, but then before bed, I was like, oh, you know, actually, maybe I'm not going to set my alarm clock because I think it's more important to get a little bit more sleep because I clearly didn't sleep super great the night before. So I decided that shifting my schedule was not as important as like making sure I was super ready to be chatting with you right now.
We appreciate it.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. In our interview, Christine emphasized the importance of finding objective ways to evaluate candidates. When used effectively, these tools can reduce disparities in hiring and compensation. That's the reason why we started Woven. Woven is a developer screening platform that reduces bias and noise in software hiring. We empower hiring managers with a detailed assessment of every candidate based on a one-hour work simulation. Our clients make decisions about who they spend time with based on ability to do the job, not just a resume. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your software team, check us out at woventeams.com.
So Google was in the news recently for announcing that they've leveled their gender pay. And I think in this case, they paid men more or something. I think that was the headline I saw. What's the problem with using within-level pay as a measure of pay equality?
I think there's like a lot of problems with that particular article. One is that like the journalist who wrote that was like literally just picking a sensationalist headline to get clicks. And that makes me angry because it's not contributing in a useful way to the conversation that's happening right now. But in terms of like what it was actually talking about, the article talked about how the metric that they were looking at was whether folks in the same level at Google were getting paid equitably. So the problem with that is that when you look at men and women and you look at racial minorities, the fact of the matter is that those folks are very often underleveled. So like they'll be hired into a position where they have more years of experience than like a typical white man does in that level. And if you're only looking at the same level, then you're losing a ton of nuance as to like how people are actually being paid or underpaid. And I've never seen like a good study at a big company where they actually managed to like correct for that kind of thing. And I don't think that the data is meaningful until you're actually able to incorporate those aspects, because the leveling ladder can be just as biased as like the pay within a band.
Gotcha. Yeah. I'm not sure. I saw several folks kind of point that on Twitter, and I think it's totally right. I'm just, trying to put myself in their shoes, I'm trying to think, how do you fix it? What's the, like, if you were, you're the CEO of Google and you've got all the millions in time, what's the thing that you think you might do? And this is a hard question, so feel free to answer that, to kind of adapt for that.
Yeah, I think that like, I don't know, there's this common thread of like, when talking about diversity and inclusion at tech companies, of people being like, well, the problem is really hard, so like maybe we'll never solve it. But like, we've built a global distributed system that connects people all around the world and is like allows you to look up in milliseconds like any piece of information you want. Like, we're really smart people. Surely like we can put a little more effort into it than that. And I think that like perhaps the piece that is missing is that I think that it all starts with listening to the folks who are not like you and who are being affected the most. And because it's hard to solve the problem when the problem doesn't affect you. And I actually have to give a lot of credit to my team for instilling in me this perspective, because they're really great. They're very vocal about their feedback. And at some point, our leadership team was talking about diversity, and someone pointed out that like our team as a whole is more diverse than our leadership team. And I spent a lot of time thinking, yeah, it is very common for a variety of reasons. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that for like days afterwards. And I just keep coming back to it whenever I think about this stuff, because it just makes so much sense to look to the people who are affected most and make sure that you're starting with their perspective. And maybe those ideas will help us make more progress than just trying to like sit in a room by ourselves and reason from our outlook.
In a Reddit AMA, you said that hiring a more diverse team requires buying into the concept, examining your own biases, and implementing solutions to address those biases. I think I see a lot of the at least spoken buying in and people talking about biases. What are some solutions that you've implemented to help at Nihilus?
So there's a few different things. In terms of like kind of like tactical things for like hiring more diversely, we do a few different things. One is obviously it starts with like the top of your funnel and working on like sourcing a variety of different people and starting conversations with them. So that's like step one. You can't do anything else if like you're not even initiating conversations with a diverse set of people. And then we focused a lot on trying to bring a rigor of standardization to how we evaluate folks. And I think there's always more room for improvement here. And obviously, like, you're never going to get to a point where, like, you're able to, like, objectively evaluate a human being on all axes. But we, especially as we've grown as a team, have more and more actually tried to like create rubrics for the questions that we ask of like what does a good answer look like? Where's the line between like hire and no hire, which I think is really useful and interesting. And there's always going to be cases where you talk to someone and what they say like falls completely outside of like anything you've thought of before, and you have to like make a judgment call as to like where that falls.
Rubrics don't have to be perfect to be better than not having a rubric.
Yeah, but it giving you a structured way to think through like what are the traits that we're looking for and what is good and what is not good, I think is really valuable. I also think it's important to just like have a culture of talking about biases and like what we should correct for and what we shouldn't. So like, for example, in our hiring wrap-up meetings for after an interview, like things will come up and like someone will say like, you know, my gut feeling while going through this was X. But after examining that gut feeling a while, I think that I shouldn't pay too much attention to that because there's this bias that can cause that feeling. And I think it's important to be able to have those kinds of conversations because have you ever read this book called Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman?
I read it twice. That's one of my favorite books.
Yeah. So gut feelings are information, and they're very useful information. They're intuitive information. But gut feelings can also be full of bias. So I think that, like, especially in the context of hiring, you want to, like, use that information and not discount it completely. But it's also useful to kind of go down the road of slow thinking and analyze that somewhat, because there are going to be cases where like you'll be feeling that gut feeling because of a very deeply ingrained bias, and you'll have a better outcome if you question it a bit.
I think in the book for his Israeli army hiring, he had people actually write down just their gut feeling, and that added to the algorithm and actually made it more predictive.
Yeah, but like especially in the tech world, like pattern matching, intuitive pattern matching is literally what has gotten us into the situation we are in today. So, like, you can't just, like, leave that by itself and say, we're just going to keep doing that.
Absolutely. It has to be part of a system. As engineers, we build systems so we can improve them.
It can feel, like, really tedious and annoying to, like, go through the process of, like, writing down exactly what you're looking for and what's good and what's bad, and it like takes time, but I think when it comes to diversity for sure and inclusion, it will lead to better outcomes.
My guest today has been Christine Spain. Christine, thank you for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks again to Christine for sharing her experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from my conversation with Christine. Number one, self-care is performance optimization. Christine learned something in college that we all eventually learn. If we want to perform our best, we have to take care of ourselves. Her demanding course load at MIT had put sleep on the back burner. If she didn't get more sleep, she was going to fail out. Her response was to identify and stick with her limits. Now she prioritizes sleep by giving herself permission to leave professional events at 9:30. She also develops rituals for winding down before bed. And finally, she uses tools like the Oura Ring to track her sleep. Number two, our sanity as a leader depends on our support network. Christine felt pressure to hold emotions in and to be stoic. As a leader, we can't always relate to our colleagues in the same way that we used to when we were just another employee. Christine used events to find a support network that understands what she was going through. Number three, static pay comparisons are incomplete. Recently, Google got press for indicating that they were underpaying many men on their staff, not women, and they corrected that salary discrepancy. Christine points out that keeping pay equal within the same level, which is what Google did, is only the very tip of the iceberg. We have to make sure that people are leveled correctly during hiring and promotions. If the promotion process is broken, that static within level view hides important information. Thanks again to Christine for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Thanks, and I'll talk to you next week.